economic suffering in the United States. And one of the problems has been is that the Democratic Party has offered people who are truly angry and scared about their futures very few solutions because they've been perceived accurately as standing for public for corporate interest and lobbyists. And so the void that has been left has been filled by these extremists on the right who use traditionally and right now economic, racial, and other forms of culturally divisive tactics in order to exploit this economic anxiety. You see that with Islamophobia. You see that with fear-mongering over immigration. And I think that's when it becomes quite dangerous, when you combine that kind of demagoguery with economic exploitation like the right is doing.
Finally, you're here in New York to participate in an event sponsored by the Brooklyn Law School on the Mavi Marmara, on the Gaza aid flotilla. It's an issue that you have taken on in a big way.
Yeah, it's Wednesday at 6 o'clock p.m. It's at Brooklyn Law School. It's open to the public. There's a dinner served with it. And I think, you know, one of the real challenges that we have is to go back and look at how the American media depicted that incident, because the level of propaganda that shaped American discourse around that event, I think, was unlike any other.
And this was very Memorial Day weekend in the United States, but it was when the Israeli commandos opened fire on the Mavi Marmara and killed eight Turks, one American citizen.
Precisely. And if you go back and do a dissection, you know, kind of a postmortem about how the American media behaved and how the American people were misled about that incident while it took place and in the weeks after, I think it's incredibly instructive, and that's what this event is intended to do.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Glenn Greenwald. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shrifo Dukadu, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. It's time once again for Off the Wall. Good evening, everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Gold Sr. with you. Sorry, we had some technical issues that had to be dealt with. And they've been dealt with. They won't be a problem anymore. We'll have new technical issues to deal with, I'm sure. Yeah, welcome. It's not quite autumn yet, but it will be in another day. But yeah, you know, we got a tornado. We got a bunch of tornadoes, actually, last Thursday, was it? Didn't hit us quite out here on the island, but boy, did Brooklyn and Queens get socked. Wow. And it's something to see when the weather authorities are saying, you know, we don't know if it was a tornado. Trees ripped up out of the ground, funnel clouds, all kinds of destruction in a five-minute period. You know, I think we don't have to wait for you guys. I think that was a tornado. No question about it. Someone actually killed on the Grand Central Parkway by a tree. Now, that's something. That's something. That shows you that we have a lot of trees in the area. If you can get killed on a highway by one of them falling on your car. But wow, that was unfortunate and scary. It didn't really, like I said, didn't really hit us out here. It was just kind of dark and thundery and rainy for a little while. But parts of Queens and Brooklyn and even Manhattan, I believe, were hit by something pretty spectacular. It's been a week for me of kind of realizing how tentative everything is. How quickly things can turn on you. Well, before I get into more of that, let me just say that officials here on Long Island are considering whether to add sirens to their arsenal of public warning devices after the tornadoes of last week. Now, we already have sirens. I'm not sure how the rest of the country works, but here on Long Island, we have sirens that go off for a number of reasons. They go off when there's a fire. That's not just to make people panic and run into the streets. It's to alert the volunteer firemen that, hey, we need you. So basically a siren goes three cycles. That means it's a fire. Get your ass down to the fire station. If it goes only once, it could mean one of two things. It could mean a rescue is needed, an ambulance or some sort of thing like that. Or it's 12 noon each time the siren goes off. It's one of those two things. I don't know what happens to the poor schmo who gets a heart attack at 12 noon and the siren goes off once and everybody just assumes, hey, it's time to have lunch. So now they want to introduce new sirens because of the tornadoes, and I'm not sure we're ready for this. I don't really. And by the way, the reason we have those sirens is because we have an all-volunteer fire department here on Long Island. Not just one. We have a new fire department every 50 feet, it seems, but they're all volunteers. And I think that's incredible that they get it all done on a volunteer basis, as well as any place that has paid fire people. And I'm wondering, you know, why don't we just do that for a lot of things? Why don't we have volunteer garbage men? Why don't we have volunteer policemen? Volunteer taxi drivers, huh? Yeah, I mean, if you really love your job, shouldn't be a problem. I'm volunteering right now. You don't see me complaining, do you? Well, okay, you see me complaining, but not about that. About all sorts of other things. And yeah, there's a lot of things. Don't even get me started. Because I could go on for... the hour I get is not enough for the things that are relevant, but it's not enough for me to complain either. Should be going for a lot longer than that. And better conditions and respect and all that kind of thing. Okay, regardless, so let me get back to the story about the tornadoes. Well, tornado sirens, that is. So officials in both Nassau and Suffolk County say they've expanded the public alert systems in recent years to include emergency updates sent by text messages and automated calls to landline home phones. Of course, that's no good if your telephone pole gets knocked down or if you don't have service where you happen to be for whatever reason. So basically what they're considering is installing a new set of sirens or sirens that can do more than one thing. This particular siren alert, if approved, would require a distinctive 10 blasts. 10 blasts so the public could tell it apart from the more common long moaning sirens. Now, I've never heard these 10 blasts. I don't know what that would sound like. It would probably scare the crap out of anybody that heard them. And I guess that's the point, is to get you to move downstairs or wherever you happen to be safe from a tornado. Now, keeping in mind, you have only about maybe 10, 20 minutes max to find out that there's a tornado in the area. So that would be something. We've only had a handful of these things over the years. I think they say there have only been 10 tornadoes in the New York area since 1950. Only 10. So does that really warrant this whole system? Not really sure. I know in places like Kansas and the Midwest, you certainly have them a lot more than here, so there is more of a reason. But I'm not sure people would really understand what the 10 blasts on the siren actually were all about. I don't know. That would be something. Hey, today's a holiday. It's the International Day of Peace. Yeah, happy International Day of Peace. You have no idea what the International Day of Peace is. Well, to be honest, I don't either. And the only reason I know this is because I looked at my calendar today to figure out if it was actually Tuesday yet again, and it was. And I saw that it said International Day of Peace on Tuesday. It's one of those little holidays, little known holidays that get marked on calendars. Not sure how you actually get your holiday to be listed. But in this particular case, it said that not only on this calendar, but a couple of different calendars I checked. Looking around, I saw no mention of it anyplace else. I saw no parades or fireworks displays or anything like that. So I went to my old friend Wikipedia to look it up and found out that the International Day of Peace, which is also known as World Peace Day, I wonder why you'd have to change that. Why would you say, we can't say World Peace Day, let's call it the International Day of Peace. You know there was some conversation someplace where people were fighting for that. Somebody was offended by World Peace Day. I'd like to know how. Maybe other worlds didn't feel included or something? Not sure. So International Day of Peace, it occurs annually on September 21st. Guess what? That's today. It's dedicated to peace, yeah, or specifically, the absence of war. Yeah, the absence of war, I guess, is not really the same thing as peace. Well, anyway, they explain it here, such as might be occasioned by a temporary ceasefire in a combat zone. So you can still have the war, but just not today. Let's take a day off. You know, it's like that period in World War I where the Germans and the English were shouting holiday greetings at each other before they started killing each other again. International Day of Peace is observed by many nations, political groups, military groups, and peoples. The first year this holiday was celebrated was 1981. And to inaugurate the day, the peace bell is rung at UN headquarters. The bell is cast from coins donated by children from all continents. Now, is that really fair? Don't kids need coins more than anybody? You know, why get the kids to give up their precious coins to make some stupid bell that you don't even know where it is, I'll bet, in the United Nations? Can we even get to it? Do you have to go through security to find the bell? Or is it out there on the front lawn? I don't think it's accessible. I don't think it's something that we can just see. So you get these starving kids from all over the world to pitch in their pennies so we can build a bell behind security barriers in the middle of New York City that gets rung once a year on a holiday nobody knows about. Yeah, that's justice. Ho-ho. So it's a wonderful occasion, the International Day of Peace. I hope you're having a peaceful day. Even if you didn't know, that's what it was. Well, I'm happy to be having any sort of a day after what happened to me. But I can't. I have to go to a feature first, I'm afraid. And then we'll talk about what happened to me. Yes.
The quest for Starbucks. The final 16 profile. Redlands.
Redlands is a city in San Bernardino County, California. And as of the 2000 census, the city had a total population of 63,591. In the 1880s, the arrival of the Southern Pacific and Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe railroads connecting Southern California to San Francisco and Salt Lake triggered a land boom, with speculators such as John W. North flooding the area, now known as the Inland Empire. North and others saw the area with its hot, dry climate and ready access to water as an ideal center for citrus production. The city of Redlands was soon established by Frank F. Brown, a civil engineer, and E.G. Judson, a New York stockbroker, to provide a center, along with North's nearby settlement at Riverside, for the burgeoning citrus industry. They named their city Redlands after the color of the adobe soil. At the turn of the 1900s, Redlands was the Palm Springs of the next century, with roses being planted along many city thoroughfares. Some of these plantings would survive as wild thickets into the 1970s, especially adjacent to orange groves, where property management was lax. Washingtonia palms were planted along many main avenues. In fact, Redlands was the first city to have center medians with trees or gardens in between roads. So beautifully kept was the area, with the dramatic mountain backdrops, that for several years, the Santa Fe Railroad operated excursion trains along the loop that passed through the orange groves of Redlands and Mentone across the Santa Ana River and back into San Bernardino via East Highlands, Highlands, and Patton, and advertised as the Kite Route due to its multi-sided alignment. The trestle over the wash north of Mentone was carried away during a flood in 1938 and never replaced, the line being truncated there. The city has been visited by three presidents. President McKinley was the first in 1901, followed by President Teddy Roosevelt in 1903 and President William H. Taft. Local landmarks include the A.K. Smiley Public Library, a Moorish-style library built in 1898, and the Redlands Bowl, built in 1930 and home of the oldest continuously free outdoor concert series in the United States. Located behind the Smiley Library is the Lincoln Shrine, the only memorial honoring the great emancipator, the 16th president, west of the Mississippi River. Redlands, one of the final 16. Well, I learned a lot from that. That's for sure. I didn't know anything about Redlands before. Now I know all kinds of things about it. Here's the thing: we have to do four of these. It's like being in commercial radio again. Again, I never was, but it's like that. Where you have to break for commercials. I'd like to ask if we can do another one, because I feel a rant coming on, and it's awfully distracting to have to break for this. If I have to do
the
simple
quest,
yes, would have been fine.
Or Starbucks. Final 16 profile.
Hong Kong. Hong Kong is one of two special administrative regions of the People's Republic of China. The territory's population is 7 million. In 1839, the refusal by Qing Dynasty authorities to import opium resulted in the first opium war between China and Britain. Hong Kong Island became occupied by British forces on January 20th of 1841. And in 1983, when Britain reclassified Hong Kong from a British crown colony to a dependent territory, the governments of Britain and China were already discussing the issue of Hong Kong's sovereignty due to the impending expiration of the lease of the new territories. In 1984, the Sino-British Joint Declaration, an agreement to transfer sovereignty to the People's Republic of China in 1997, was signed. It stipulated that Hong Kong would be governed as a special administrative region, retaining its laws and a high degree of autonomy for at least 50 years after the transfer. Under the principle of one country, two systems, Hong Kong's economic and political systems differ from those of mainland China. Hong Kong is one of the world's leading international financial centers, with a major capitalist service economy characterized by low taxation and free trade. Under colonial rule, it espoused minimum government intervention under the theory of positive non-interventionism. The Hong Kong dollar is the ninth most traded currency in the world. In 2009, Hong Kong hosted the fifth East Asian Games, competed by competed with nine national teams. What a lousy sentence that is. It was the first and largest international multi-sport event ever held in the territory. And today, Hong Kong continues to serve as an important global financial center, but faces uncertainty over its future due to the growing mainland China economy and its relationship with the PRC government in areas such as democratic reform and universal suffrage. Hong Kong, one of the final 16. Gotta say, it's getting pretty exciting. It's winding down. We're doing a feature on all the 16. We've already done, we've done 10 now. 10 of the 16, so we're over the hump. And the drawings resume in October with the final scheduled for December 7th. That's where I find out where the first Starbucks I've ever been to in my life will be. Where in the world? We started with every single one of them. Now we're down to 16. It's incredible. Well, hopefully I'll survive until then. As I hinted at before, boy, what a week it's been. I had an interesting little adventure with my car the other day where I was driving down a road, which I tend to do, and just starting up again from a stop sign, all of a sudden I got this feeling like I had a flat tire. And I don't know if people have experience with that. If you've ever had that experience, it's not pleasant. You just suddenly feel this dragging sensation, and it's very hard to steer. And it just seemed kind of weird that all of a sudden, after stopping at a stop sign, I would suddenly have a flat tire, a completely flat tire. It didn't make sense. It made a lot more sense that I'd just run over somebody that I couldn't possibly see who had dove under my car while I had stopped or something like that. So I got out and looked around and felt the tires, and things seemed okay, but clearly they weren't. And basically what I did was I turned around and kind of hobbled back to where I had started from. It was about a half mile, so I wasn't really far away from a place that would be safe. But boy, was it hard driving, and I couldn't figure out why. I don't have a flat tire. What's going on here? Is my car just falling apart? Well, turns out what happened was, and I found this out when I got back and looked at the car and realized that while one tire was facing straight ahead, the other tire was facing 90 degrees in the other direction. So I was kind of moving that one sideways. What happened was the control arm, I never even knew about this part, but the control arm just snapped, just broke. It basically was so rusted out. And this car is almost 20 years old. It's only 17, actually. Almost has a 250,000 miles on it. So it's just a couple thousand miles away from this. It's in good condition. It runs fine. But apparently it had this catastrophic failure that I was completely unaware of. And it just happened, just snapped like that. It had rusted out to such a degree that it just couldn't take it anymore. So my question is, what would have happened if I was on the highway when that happened? You know, and everyone I've talked to so far says, oh, you're lucky to be alive. Something like that happens. And when I think about it, when I think about how this actually transpired, very close to my point of origin, where I could hobble back at a stop sign at night where there really wasn't any traffic, could have gone so badly in so many different ways. But the thing that that really kind of gets me here is that why wasn't something like this ever found? Why isn't something like this looked for? Apparently these kinds of things can happen, and you just don't know about it till it happens. Yeah, and it makes me really paranoid. It makes me want to check everything now, make sure that is my house going to stand up tonight? Is it going to fall down? Is something rotting out? You have to check basically everything. Now, September for me has already been a week of health. A month of health. Yeah, let's get it right. September's a month. Okay, so it was basically the month where I got all kinds of checkups and maintenance and things like that, because you know how it is. You just sort of put things off and you don't get things checked like you should get things checked on a regular basis. It's something we all need to do. And it's hard. I realize it's hard with schedules and with insurance companies. Oh, my God. It's a nightmare. But it's a bigger nightmare if you don't check into things and you don't know about possible conditions and things go badly for you. And you could have done something about it if you had only looked a little sooner. Same thing with my car. If I had known that something was going wrong, then I would have definitely done something about it. Unfortunately, I am not my car. Well, I guess that's not unfortunate. But if I was the actual car, I'd see, hey, this doesn't feel right. Something's rotting away here. And I'd be able to say, this needs attending to. But not being the car myself, I don't have the knowledge to go in and see, okay, this is something that shouldn't be like this. This has to be over there instead of over here. I assume that when you have the annual inspections that the state requires, that things like that are checked out. Apparently they're not, because I've asked a number of people, and that's not part of the safety check. That's not part of the safety check. The fact that your control arm can snap and your wheels can just simply fly in all different directions, that's not part of it. So you have to wonder, how many other things are there that they're not telling you about that can just, at a moment's notice, just simply break in two and have you hurtling through the air? Very, very sobering, very scary. Now, the interesting thing, medically, too, it's also been interesting because I figured, you know, why not? I deserve the best. I deserve the presidential checkup, like, you know, that puts you on a treadmill. I've never been on one of those treadmills before, except for exercising myself. I've never gone to the doctor, had them hook all these things up to you, and basically monitor you while you're running, while you're exerting yourself. So I demanded, in a nice way, of course, I demanded that I get the full treatment, everything. I just want to get everything that I'm entitled to or that I need to get at this particular stage in my life. And basically, I found a doctor that agreed, that said, okay, we can do all this. And that's hard to do. Sometimes you get these doctors that don't even want to examine you. They just want to have a conversation. They just want to get it over with as quickly as possible. And some of them are obese. Some of them are smoking. It's almost funny, except it's your life we're talking about here. So you got to get somebody that actually takes an interest and does their job. And you have to know if they don't do that to find somebody who does. And yeah, this can get really difficult with insurance and with attitudes of people that run these establishments. Sometimes you call up and you say, yeah, I'm not feeling well. I need an appointment. Well, the next appointment is in 6 months. I've had that conversation, and it's insane. And anybody who can sit here and tell me that our healthcare in this country does not need radical surgery, you're deceiving yourself, or you've got one hell of a plan that very few other people have. All I know is if you want to get treatment, it's a fight. It really is a struggle. And I haven't begun to tell you the nightmare I went through with this. I'm still going through with this whole project. And yeah, it's a project. Simply taking care of yourself can be a project. And I like I said, I did the whole shebang, where I was on the treadmill and it was pretty cool. Actually, the thing that that kind of got me concerned was I went to one of those drugstore blood pressure machines, you know, where they, for free, they basically do this thing while you're waiting for a prescription. And for the first time in my life, it actually was higher than it normally was. Like, it said pre-hypertension, and I didn't like the sound of that. And so that's what got me to demand an appointment with a doctor the next couple of days, and I got one. And I went in, got checked up, turned out the drugstore machine was probably just miscalibrated and there wasn't an issue, but it was the door opening to getting other things taken care of, including all kinds of blood work and the stress test, which is what they call the thing on the treadmill. And that's fun, because what they do is they lie you down and they stick all these things onto you, and they take your blood pressure, they take your pulse rate, then they tell you to get on the treadmill, and it keeps going faster and faster, and they want to get your heart rate up to over 140 beats per minute. Yeah, and that's a lot, because usually it's something like 70 or 80. Athletes, it's even lower than that. And I was able to get it up to 165. And what you're supposed to do, you're supposed to tell them, you're supposed to give them 30 seconds warning, maybe even 60 seconds warning, of when you feel like maybe you can't go any further. It's kind of hard to do. It's kind of hard to say, by the way, in a minute, I'm going to be really exhausted. But you try to do that, and then you dive back onto the stretcher, and you lie on your side while they take pictures with your heart racing at this incredible speed. And then they tell you to do things like, okay, exhale and hold In other words, don't breathe in. Now, if your heart's going 165 beats a minute, you really want to breathe in. It's very difficult to lie there and just hold your breath out. Yeah, it's a challenge, but it's your health. It's worth it. It's worth doing this kind of thing. Another thing, very important, is something that I cannot stress enough to people listening of all ages, because it's going to be something that concerns all of us at one point or another, and that's a colonoscopy. Yeah. Now, I have a history in my family of colon cancer, so it's a good idea to do this every now and then. I've already done it a couple of times, and this, I think, was my third time doing it. And it's interesting to see how the technology changes over the years, how it gets less and less invasive. And what you basically have to do is you have to spend a day basically ingesting a liquid that you like, something with flavor, but you pour this evil stuff into it that basically, how do I say this delicately? It basically cleans you out in no uncertain terms. And you have to drink 64 ounces of this in 3 hours, and then just sort of wait for nothing else to be going on for you that entire evening. And then after midnight, you can't eat or drink anything. And the result is when you show up the next day, you are completely cleaned out. And they need that because when they inspect you, they need to be able to have a clear picture. That's about as G-rated as I can say all that. Now, I have to stress, it's not that bad when you actually show up and they actually do the procedure. The worst part is not having food you like and having to go to the bathroom an awful lot the day before. It's kind of unpleasant. But you know, if you're really, really sick, that's going to happen anyway, you know, and you won't be doing this with the aid of these evil chemicals or whatever it is that you're ingesting. So basically what they do is they then inspect you, and you have the option of either going completely under or being semi-conscious. And I always like to be semi-conscious. I like to sort of see what's going on and be aware of what's happening. But the interesting thing here is that you lose track of time. And we had just gotten to the point where they had begun the exam, and literally 30 seconds later, it was over. Or so it seemed. And obviously, they couldn't have done that in 30 seconds. It took about probably 20, 25 minutes. And what they told me afterwards when I got out was, okay, all done. And guess what? We found a polyp. And we removed it. Now, a polyp is this little growth that could one day turn into something evil. Yeah, and even that is enough to kind of freak me out. It's like the pre-hypertension. Well, this could potentially be pre-cancerous. You know, it's a couple of steps removed, but it's enough to make you realize this is important. You have to get this done. This thing would have been there had I not gotten the exam, and it could have turned into something really bad. And I wasn't even aware that they had found anything, that they had taken anything out. It just was incredibly smooth, no pain whatsoever. So what I'm trying to emphasize to people is that this is something that can affect anybody, regardless of whether or not there's history in your family. And if you get to a certain age, and I really think once you're over 30, it's time to start looking at this and not dreading it. Because except for the one day of mild discomfort, and I'm talking about the day where you're not eating or drinking what you want to drink and eat, the procedure itself is a breeze. The peace of mind you get from that is simply astounding. But, and there's a big but here. The day before all this happened, I got this call from the people that were preparing to do all this saying, by the way, Manuel, your insurance company says that you don't exist. That, or not that you don't exist, but that your insurance is canceled as of August 1st. And I was basically floored by that. I said, well, that's interesting, seeing as how I just paid them for October and they sent me a bill in September. How is it that I'm canceled as of August and I didn't receive any notice? And basically they said, well, you're going to have to work that out with them and bring money tomorrow if you don't work it out with them. Kind of, you know, these weren't the people, these weren't the doctors, these are the billing people. And my basic philosophy about all this is that, well, you know, the doctor doesn't get involved with all this billing nonsense, with all this pettiness. The doctor just basically works on the procedure. They have these nasty billing people that call you up and threaten you. Well, I'm the patient. I don't think I should be involved in the billing nonsense either. So I choose not to let myself get stressed over this. And yeah, they're talking down to me saying, well, you know, you don't have insurance, so you're going to have to bring cash and nonsense like that. I'm like, yeah, whatever. You know what? This is not my problem. Somebody screwed up someplace. I'll make a phone call and deal with it and figure it out. But I'm going through with this regardless. So it turns out this is the weird thing, because I had this whole investigation launched. I actually have an insurance broker, which is a good thing to have, because you can simply yell at them and they'll do all the investigation. What happened was basically there was some kind of disagreement a year ago as to how much was owed. And when I sent in a check, they applied it to a previous month, except they never told me this. And this kept going on, and there was another disagreement, except for the fact that they never sent a bill saying what the other amount was that they believed I owed. And every single month does not have a balance. Now, maybe their software is incapable of having a balance carried over. So I had no knowledge of this whatsoever. None. So what happened was, down there at the insurance company, they were getting more and more red-faced and enraged by my refusal to pay them when they never sent a bill in the first place. And eventually they just got so annoyed that they just canceled me. And here's the other thing. Here's the kicker. I never got a notice that I was canceled. And I think I know why. I think I know how they managed to sidestep the requirement that they have to give you a notice that they're canceling your insurance. On the back of every single bill is a notice to terminate your insurance if you don't pay the bill. Yeah, every single time they send out a bill, they also send out a cancellation notice. I mean, that can't be legal, but that's what they're doing. They're notifying you by default, and if you don't pay, they don't have to notify you again. Or if they say you didn't pay. So the whole thing is just insane, and I realize this is my invitation to get drawn into this world of stress, of annoyances with petty bureaucrats that simply live to cause misery. And I said, you know, I have enough to deal with this week. I've got these exams and procedures and things like that to deal with. I have rust under my car that I don't know about yet that might kill me next week. All kinds of things that are more important than this. You guys can wait. And somehow, when I went in for the procedure, I was able to bypass all the billing people and just get the procedure and leave. And, you know, I have no problem with that. I have no problem with getting myself taken care of and, if necessary, not paying for it if I feel I'm entitled to have it covered by my insurance. I'm not going to get dragged into that. Just like if I'm starving, I have no problem stealing food, as nobody should have problems doing that, because you have certain rights. Whether or not somebody in the Tea Party tells you you have these rights or not, you do. You have the right to be healthy. You have the right to be fed. Now, you don't have the right to be well-fed, but you do have the right to not starve. These are just basic rights that no country can give you. These are the rights that you have as a creature in this on this planet. I say so, okay? So, yeah, that's the fun I was going through. Also, blood work. Got all kinds of blood tests done. Actually, they only take your blood once. Here's the other thing. I had this interesting conversation with the people at the blood bank, basically getting everything tested for, and, you know, all kinds of different diseases. And I just asked, by the way, is HIV included in that? Oh, no. If you want that, you have to go back to your doctor, and you have to get counseling, and you have to fill out all these forms. And it suddenly turned into this big crisis. I was just asking a question. Is that included? I figure, you know, why not have everything checked at once? I'm not particularly worried about anything, but why not get everything checked? Just like with my car, why not get everything checked when it's in for the safety inspection to see if maybe something's going to break and cause you grief down the road? But it turned into all this drama when I simply was asking a question. Now, I know that there are reasons why these particular stipulations are in place, but I think sometimes it's overdone a little bit, And it might be enough to sort of scare people into not getting things tested and not finding out things. Some of the explanations I got were, well, you know, we want to make sure that you're prepared for the results. Well, you know, no one is preparing me for the results of the colonoscopy or the other blood tests that could also indicate fatal diseases. And HIV certainly isn't even a fatal disease anymore. It's not a death sentence. I mean, Magic Johnson, that's how long ago was it that he announced he was HIV positive? It's, yeah, there are all kinds of concerns, all kinds of discrimination out there. And that's the problem that should be focused upon. So I don't know. It was just kind of a weird conversation there. And I realized that the health industry is just bizarre and strange and filled with intrigue and conflict and contradictions, things like that. So that was my week. That was my week of car adventures and health adventures, and actually continues. I like I said, all September is health month in my world, and it's good maybe once a year, once every couple of years to have these things checked out. So if you are in a position where you're wondering about, well, am I healthy or not, find out. Just go get checkups. Don't worry about insurance. Don't worry about bills and things like that, because you're worth it. You're worth whatever it is. And some stresses are just not legitimate stresses that society throws your way. But yeah, you know, if you really think that our healthcare does not need a facelift after just this little taste of it, people go through so much worse. They go through all kinds of garbage just to get basic healthcare. If you think that it's working now, there's some kind of drug you're taking that's probably not legal. Really, the only way, the only fair system is where people don't have to worry about this. Don't have to worry about this basic right, where you have enough to eat, where you are kept healthy, and that is your basic human right as a citizen of any country. And any country that doesn't do that for you is not living up to its its potential. I guess that's enough to have me labeled a socialist or a Marxist or whatever it is that these people love to label people as, but that's just how I see it. All right, are we ready for number three? So I told you I had a rant coming on. We couldn't have broken that up. All right, I feel better now.
The quest for Starbucks. Final 16 profile. Edmonton.
And it reduces your stress, too, to rant. Oh, Edmonton is the capital of the Canadian province of Alberta. The city is located on the North Saskatchewan River in the central region of the province, an area with some of the most fertile farmland on the prairies. It is the second largest city in Alberta after Calgary and is the hub of Canada's sixth largest census metropolitan area. In the Canada 2006 census, the city had a population of 730,372. Correct. Edmonton is Canada's second most populous provincial capital after Toronto and is a cultural, governmental, and educational center. It plays host to a year-round slate of world-class festivals, earning it the title of the Festival City. It is home to the North America's largest mall, which is West Edmonton Mall, and that was the world's largest mall for 23 years, from 1981 until 2004. And also Fort Edmonton Park, Canada's largest living history museum. In 2004, Edmonton celebrated the centennial of its incorporation as a city. Edmonton was judged to have the best economic potential of any North American city by the Financial Times publication FDI Magazine. The Edmonton International Fringe Festival, which takes place in mid-August, is the largest fringe theater festival in North America, second only to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival worldwide. In August, Edmonton is also host to the Edmonton Folk Music Festival, one of the most successful and popular folk music festivals in North America. Another major summer festival is the Edmonton Heritage Festival, which is an ethno-cultural festival that takes place in Harilac Park on the Heritage Day long weekend. Many other... Can I stop saying festival? said festival too many damn times. I have to say it? Okay, fine. Many other festivals exist, such as the Free Will Shakespeare Festival, the Dragon Boat Festival, the White Avenue Art Walk, and the Edmonton International Film Festival. Edmonton, one of the final 16. Don't mean to make light of it like that, but really, I mean, it's just sometimes the copy editors go a little crazy with repeating words. All right, you know, speaking of mortality and there, but for the grace of God go I and all that kind of thing. Check this out. Tropical Depression 11E. Yeah. Yeah, Tropical Depression 11E. Now, you heard about Hurricane Earl. You heard about all these other storm events that have been happening. But did you really hear about Tropical Depression 11E? You probably didn't. Well, let me tell you the story. Tropical Depression 11E was a short-lived but devastating tropical cyclone that killed 48 people in Guatemala and Costa Rica. The depression quickly formed on September 3rd, 2010, out of a low-pressure system embedded with a monsoonal trough. Yeah, okay, the point is, there's a lot of information here about this. How many of us ever heard about this? This happened this month. Didn't even have a name. Storm didn't even get a name. Just Tropical Depression 11E. Why is it called 11E? Is there 11F and 11G? How many of these things are there? Wow. I mean, that's a lot. So, yeah, you know, the highest winds were 45 miles an hour. 45 miles an hour. 35 to 45 miles an hour. Not even 45. And it's part of the 2010 Pacific hurricane season. It's like a football season. Yeah, the 2010 Pacific hurricane season. Who will go to the top? Well, definitely not Tropical Depression 11E. It didn't even get a name. It wasn't even a tropical storm. But it still killed 48 people. And we never heard of it. Makes you think, doesn't it? Makes you think. As does the way the world is moving in so many places. You hear about the French expulsion of the Roma people? Yeah. People you might know as gypsies, which is not a very nice term. Roma is a better term, and they come from various parts of Europe. Many of them are from Romania. Many, many years ago, they came from India. And you see them in various parts of Europe, and they're always treated badly. And the French have basically kicked them out, put them on planes, put them on buses, sent them back home, given them money to say, stay away. A lot of them are already coming back. You see, the thing is, when you have open borders, as the European Union has, that means open borders for everybody. That means the French are allowed to go to Romania. That means the Romanians are allowed to go to France. Simple as that. But many people in France aren't happy seeing these people who often are unemployed or uneducated or living in squalor. Rather than dealing with those situations, they'd rather just move the people out someplace else. And most French people support this. They think that's the right thing to do. It's kind of like their anti-immigration group of people like we have here. Now, in Sweden, for the first time in ages, or ever maybe, a far-right party won a significant amount of seats in Sunday's election. Yeah. Now, the Sweden Democrats, it's kind of weird because different parties have different names in different countries, and they mean completely different things. For instance, in Australia, the Liberals are conservative. And here, the Sweden Democrats are far right. And they say all of Europe is suffering big problems from mass immigration. And, of course, people are becoming more and more frustrated in several European countries, which we can see from the election results. The Sweden Democrats won 5.7% of the vote on Sunday, and a place in the national parliament for the first time. Now, in this country, 5.7% would be meaningless, wouldn't get you anything. But in other democratic countries, it gets you representation. And the worry now is that since none of the other parties got a clear majority, these guys might have more power than you might think. The spokesman for the Swedish Democrats says, "We now have a platform for ideology, and that is very important because we know that we have a big opportunity to get even more supporters." He said his party did not hold racist views. "We have a situation where neither of the coalitions holds a majority, which can prove problematic in the long run if we can't find a solution. So then it'll be our responsibility to hold conversations, be ready to cooperate with all parties, but it is also their responsibility to talk to us." And basically, those other parties so far are saying they're not going to do that. They're not going to bargain with these people. It'll be interesting to see where this goes, but it also is a reflection of how people are thinking, how they're acting, where they're venting their hostilities, many times against Muslims, many times against immigrants. Sweden, often with the most liberal immigration policies in the world. This is a big deal. This is something that we'll be seeing the effects of for some time to come. And back in this country, this is interesting. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, remember him? Yeah, he's still out there. He repeatedly brought social conservatives to their feet on Saturday at the one of these conservative rallies. It's called the Values Voters Summit, actually. He gave an impassioned address in which he warned that America faces a dual threat from Islamic terrorists on one side and the Democratic establishment on the other. Isn't that great? Isn't that mature to basically equate your opponents in your own government with terrorists and get away with it? Not be called on it. Not be shown to be an idiot for making people believe in that way. Fostering hate, that kind of thing. But yet we're seeing that everywhere. We're seeing it in Europe. We're seeing it in America. We're seeing it in Asia. We're seeing it in Africa. And we're seeing it in Australia as well. Did I leave anybody out? Yeah, South America too. Well, you count as America. These are sad days, but I think if we stay vigilant and awake, we'll get through them.
The quest for Starbucks. The final 16 profile. Sherwood
is a city in Washington County, Oregon, located in the southeast corner of the county. It is a residential community in the Tualatin Valley, southwest of Portland. Population was 11,791 in 2000. The name Sherwood arose from a declination of naming the town Smockville after its co-founders, James Christopher and Mary Ellen Smock. In 1885, the Smocks gave a right-of-way on their property to the Portland and Willamette Valley Railway. The Smocks platted the town in 1889, the same year rail service began. Tradition has it that no one, not even the town's founders, liked the name Smockville, and so a public meeting was held to rename the town. A prominent businessman, Robert Alexander, suggested the name Sherwood. According to post office records, Alexander was from Sherwood, Michigan, and this was the town that was named after Sherwood Forest in England. The U.S. Postal Department began sending mail to the town of Sherwood, Oregon on July 5, 1891, and the first postmaster was Smock. In 2007, a nationwide magazine placed Sherwood among the 20 most livable towns in America. That's Money Magazine, July 2007. In August 2009, Family Circle Magazine named the town one of America's most family-friendly small towns. Sherwood, Sherwood, one of the final 16. You know, it's interesting. It's fascinating. I enjoy it. kind of takes the wind out of my sails, though, when I'm giving this impassioned talk about politics and hatred and racism and things like that, to all of a sudden have to go into one of those spots. But you know what? That's what commercial radio is like. We're non-commercial, so we don't normally do that kind of thing. And it is sort of my own fault because I happen to tell people that, yeah, I've never been to Starbucks and I'd like to try have a countdown this year and sort of got out of control and I will never do that again. Our email address is otw@2600.com. You can write to us with your comments, suggestions, regrets, or experiences, or corrections. I'm sure there are many of those. We'd love to hear from you. Really, we would, no matter how nasty or sarcastic you might get. otw@2600.com. My name is Emmanuel. The program has been Off the Wall. Keep listening to WUSB in Stony Brook, and we'll be back again next week. Good night.
Hey, kids, it's Finn. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. It's about 7:01. This is Finn's Revolution. We're going to be giving away some tickets to the movies tonight and some other cool events, so stay tuned for all that, plus tons of cool, new, and old music. Stay tuned.
Thank you. Tell him, honey, of the sunny side.